This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of the station management, Tufts University administration, or the Board of Trustees. My show comes to you every Friday this summer from 6 to 8 p.m. Today on the program, a very special interview with Dr. Robert Malone, one of the inventors of mRNA and DNA vaccine technology. He speaks here with Brett Weinstein on Brett's The Dark Horse podcast. This interview was recorded on May 22nd, 2022 in Bath, England, right after the A Better Way for a Better World conference. This interview runs for 2 hours straight. We will run straight through until 8 o'clock. If you're interested in more information like this, there's a festival coming to New York City, the Minds.com Festival of Ideas. That's M-I-N-D-S.com. The Festival Ideas happens on June 25th, next Saturday, at 7 p.m. at the Beacon Theater. You can buy tickets for online live stream access. They are less than $16, and you will have access for 2 weeks to view all of the presentations at your own time. Minds.com Festival of Ideas, June 25th in New York. Now, Dr. Robert Malone and Brett Weinstein on the Dark Horse Podcast.
Only about 10% of the population really wants freedom. The majority of the population, in his assessment, as a professional, I mean, this is what he does, study crowds and crowd behavior, the majority of the population wants to be told what to do. And one of the core tenets in authoritarianism that's been documented, you know, for decades now, Hannah Arendt and Gustave Le Bon, etc., is that if one is going to choose, if there is a desire to implement a totalitarian structure, the best leadership strategy is to be very domineering. People seem to want to have an authoritarian leader. That's why authoritarianism and totalitarianism always come together like this.
Hey folks, welcome to the Dark Horse Podcast. I am, of course, sitting with Dr. Robert Malone, who you all know, he's a repeat guest on Dark Horse. And those of you who have been following know that the episode that Robert and I did with Steve Kirsch was removed from YouTube. Our channel was struck and demonetized. It remains demonetized. And so this is round two. Welcome back, Robert.
Thanks, Brett. It's good to see you again.
It's great to see you.
We've had chances to touch base, but not a chance to record anything together since then. So I really look forward to our chat.
Yeah, me too. And I will say I have thought many, many times that we should do a podcast again. And the obstacle has been, I felt it was important to do it in person. And it has been, you've been all over the world. And that has made it hard to arrange a meeting. But we are here together at a conference, which is more or less a conference of COVID dissidents, I would say, from various parts of that movement. And it's fascinating. It's the first time that I have been in a place where there was such a concentration of people who were awake about the questions surrounding COVID.
Yeah, you have to be pretty careful about use of the language around that concept of awokenness. Given how, you know, this is another case where language has been captured for political movements. And I'm with you. Wakes feels like the right term. It's just now kind of politically contaminated. People who are not caught in the mass formation hypnosis process, let's say.
Yes. And I agree with you. I even feel like the term woke had an honorable meaning that I would have aspired to, you know, several years ago, and that the word has been turned on its head effectively.
Well, you're kind of the poster child for that trajectory.
Yeah. Interestingly, tomorrow is the 5-year anniversary of the day that I was catapulted into the spotlight at the wrong end of an angry mob who demanded my resignation.
Yeah. I gotta say my heart goes out to you for what you've experienced. I'm so glad that I had stepped out of academe before this trend happened. I can't imagine for those who are not able to reconcile themselves with this
current environment, what it must, how painful it must be to be an academic and not buy into this dominant narrative and culture.
Yeah, I will say my patience with people remaining in the academy is running thin, because my sense is this movement is so aggressive and so clearly wrong that if you're still hanging in there, you're probably not saying enough. And, you know, there are exceptions. There are some academics that I know are fighting from within, but it's not many of them.
Yeah, Jay Bhattacharya is an example of someone who is choosing to walk that fine line. I think this is something that a number of folks have had problems coming to terms with. There's the argument, as you know, because you were leading this panel yesterday, there's the argument to basically self-censor and select carefully chosen language, or in the case of J.P. Sears, he just mumbles whenever instead of saying the word vaccine, and we all know what he's saying, but it escapes the filters. And that's why he's able to stay on. So I think that there people face that choice of whether to self-censor and walk a very fine line. Even Neil Oliver was talking about it. Versus those like myself that have come to the decision and the belief that I will be attacked, censored, defamed, etc., no matter whether I elect to try to walk the fine line or not. And it was kind of that realization that led to me, my personal choice that led to me pushing the window on Twitter, which of course led to me being deplatformed because I had posted the Canadian COVID Care Alliance video about the Pfizer data manipulations in their clinical trials, every bit of which is true and factual.
It was documented right in the video, in fact.
Yeah, but it met the current definition of mis and disinformation, a failure to comport with community standards as defined by Twitter, which is essentially that any messaging which might be interpreted as causing vaccine hesitancy, whether grounded in truth or not, is disallowed.
Yeah, and we learned the playbook after you were rejected from Twitter, that in fact, this was a head scratcher back when all we had was mis and disinformation. It is the invention of the term malinformation that tells us where we really are. And I should point out, I said this on the panel yesterday, that the Department of Homeland Security alerts us to three types of terrorism. Misinformation are honest errors, disinformation are intentional errors, and malinformation are truths that cause you to distrust government, which means to the extent that your government is not trustworthy and you discuss it, you are guilty of terrorism, which of course, as you know, puts you into a very special category, a category with no rights. And the fact is, by virtue of this being housed in the Department of Homeland Security, it is effectively at the discretion of the executive to decide if you are or are not in the category. You will not know that you have been placed in the category. And once placed in the category, you have no rights.
Every time I go through airport security, which is fairly frequent these days, I have a moment of, is this going to be the moment where they're going to pull me out of line? Virtually all the docs that had touch points on January 6th in any way have had that experience of being pulled out of line. I'm aware of a female physician that I'm not going to share who's been strip searched by Homeland Security by TSA when trying to pass through. It's profound, the changes that have occurred that have been implemented incrementally and which we as a culture have accommodated ourselves to. I gave a rally in Oahu back last fall where I made the point, I suspect it'll resonate with you, that it wasn't so long ago that we all felt sorry for the Chinese people because they had to live under a censored internet in which the government controlled what they were able to say and when they were able to say it, and in which the government tracked them and would implement all kinds of activities to control their behavior and their speech. And we felt at the time, and I remember thinking, those poor people, they have to carry internal passports. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
We were all so shocked that the CCP was implementing an internal passport system. And we all told ourselves that it's never happened in the United States because we have a Bill of Rights. And here we are. I think it's helpful to walk that back in your memory, to be able to kind of cognitively process how much change we've experienced and come to accept.
No, I agree. And if I consciously go through the exercise of trying to preserve a memory of what it was like so that I know how big the delta is. I will say, I think the concept that we're looking for was absolutely nailed by William Binney, who was an NSA officer, I guess, who turned whistleblower. And what he said, and this was years back now, as he said,
pre-Snowden.
This was right in the Snowden era.
Okay.
He said, we are this close to a turnkey totalitarian state. And the idea that the totalitarian state might be erected around you, but the key not be turned. And so you wouldn't detect it, right? Because although you and I are certainly going to discuss true things that are sure to cause distrust of the government and therefore somehow meet an insane definition of terrorism right here in this podcast, we could hardly avoid it, right?
Right.
We will certainly not know whether
We've already crossed that line.
We've crossed that line, right. So the point is, I didn't feel anything, did you? Right? Did we become terrorists in somebody's eyes? Will somebody look at this video and say, they've crossed that line?
Our mutual colleague and friend, James Heckman, makes the point, and this is why he was so strongly counseling that I not speak and that the physicians not be engaged in any of the trucker events. And I did not completely follow his guidance, and I did speak out at Hagerstown, is that all of this information now is archived. And his point is not that it's going to be weaponized in the present, but that it's going to be weaponized in the future.
Well, so I have a different version of this. I call it retroactive surveillance. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, if you just hoover up all of the information, all of the correspondence, people have the sense of, well, there's no way they're reading my email. Who am I? They're not noticing me. So I have a certain amount of safety, but you don't, because what happens is it exists in a bank. And if 5 years later you become interesting to them, they can go backwards into your history.
That's precisely the point. And I agree. And it leads to we're all kind of numbed now to what's happening. There's something I wanted to mention, though, about all this, that we're in the process of building this book for Skyhorse Publishing, The Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Way Ahead. And I'm desperately seeking the better way ahead. I have a little trouble with that one.
Yeah.
But the lies part is pretty easy. But the point I wanted to make was forces Jill and I, my wife, Dr. Jill Glaspell Malone, to... because we're working the book together, to do exactly this journey that you're talking about of revisiting these events, this cascade of events. And one of the ones, you probably get the question also, you actually related your answer about ivermectin with this key op-ed position piece that you read in an obscure travel journal that was, you felt Pulitzer Prize material covering Pierre Corey's journey.
Mm-hmm.
With ivermectin, which was a kind of a seminal turning point you spoke about intellectually for you. And I get that same question all the time. What caused you, Robert, to start speaking out? And historically, I've often gone back to that Dark Horse podcast that we shared as a pivot event. And it was. But before that, we had this experience where I got this notification that I talked about in your podcast from Michael Callahan, who was in Wuhan in the fourth quarter of 2019, called me in January 4th, and said, get your team going. And what happened then, what that triggered, I don't think we talked about it in the prior podcast, what that triggered was me setting up the team that I already had in place that I was helping lead, that was doing high-end computational stuff for discovering repurposed drugs for organophosphate, in other words, biowarfare agents, chemical agents. And
so you were working on things that effectively treat exposure to these biowarfare agents?
Exactly. Yeah. Doing drug discovery using biorobots and computational docking and the latest cool tech. And so I kind of pivoted that team to work on drug repurposing, which is what eventually led to the famotidine thing. Mm-hmm. But what Jill did was, because she's very community oriented, she got going and started writing a book for self-publication on Amazon that was titled, as I recall, Novel Coronavirus, How to Prepare and Protect for Yourself, or something like that was the title. There was no the nomenclature that we now have of COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2 didn't exist at the time. Mm-hmm. So we referred to it as the novel coronavirus. And she worked her can off just day and night. I remember just sitting there working together side by side on the couch. And I helped edit it and I wrote a chapter, but she wrote most of it. It was a major effort for her. And she got it published in the first week in February and through Amazon. And the sales started climbing and was well received, all 5-star ratings and everything. And her strategy had been, as an avid user of Kindles historically, that this would allow her to update this thing in real time as events developed. And so it was like on the third revision in March, and she uploaded the revision and it got held. And it got held for a couple of days. And she inquired and they said, oh, it's just taking us longer than usual to process. And then she inquired again and they came back and they said that they wouldn't be able to allow it to continue to be published and they would pull it. Mm. And she inquired repeatedly because their policy had always been that they would give authors an opportunity to learn from the reviewers or whomever had made the decision about why this should be pulled. You know, you used a 4-letter word or whatever your sin was. And the notification she got was what, you know, this phrase that's now infamous. At the time, it was the first time we've ever encountered it. You have violated community standards. Mm. Okay. Was the specific language. And we looked, we just pored over what they listed as their community standards. And there was nothing that was remotely applicable to anything that was in the content of the book. And other people have looked at the book since. It's entirely innocuous. It's talking about, bathroom practices to avoid fecal-oral transmission and using alcohol wipes in airplanes and grow your own garden and, you know, this kind of preparedness stuff. And she advocated mask use. I think might have been the sin of the book because at the time, Tony Fauci was saying no masks. And so she was, brokenhearted. The truth is, I mean, it's kind of depressing when you put your heart and soul into something, work for multiple weeks, get it out. You're trying to help your community. You're trying to do the right thing. You're trying to help save people. And then it's just deleted with no appeal. And so she dug in. It turns out that there was a meeting convened by the World Health Organization in February with virtually all the major big tech players that we're now familiar with, where the WHO initially discussed the need to control information about this pandemic. Of course, we now know that this is one of the characteristics that went into the planning for Event 201 was how to control information. So in retrespect, you know, none of us, Event 201, I had never heard of Event 201 at the time.
Right.
None of us really had that context. Now it's in retrospect that we look back, we see that there was planning for how to implement censorship and these deploy these other kinds of strategies. But I think it's important to remember that there's, and in the book we have the documentation about this, that there was a WHO initiative in February of 2020, at a time when the Trump administration was still largely in denial that this represented a major bio threat. And then shortly thereafter, there was another meeting convened in the White House with Amazon and others, including Washington Post, and Washington Post covered it, in which the strategy for censorship, essentially, I don't know what else to call it, was actively discussed together with big tech, and big tech was recruited. Now we know that through, you know, thanks to, I think it was the Blazes Freedom of Information Act, we now know about the $1 billion expended by our government to promote whatever messaging that they, you know, we have yet to discover what that messaging was in coordination with tech. And I look forward to Jeff Landry's lawsuit in which he's suing the government and Facebook for collusion on this censorship and information control. And I think when we get to discovery, we're going to learn all kinds of stuff that we probably didn't want to know, but we kind of need to.
I wonder if it will have the impact that it should. I find that there's so much shocking information that we're just inured to it. And if we realize the implications, we would be motivated to do something because they are dire.
So as you know, since we spoke, I've spent a fair amount of time with this interesting guy from named Matthias Desmet, this interesting academic that I ran into many months ago from a podcast and have developed a fairly close friendship. And we spent time in Spain together. And we cut podcasts fairly frequently. So Matthias, in addition to his insights in his upcoming English version of his book, The Psychological Basis of Totalitarianism, also is writing another book, and we continue to kind of develop those ideas and talk about it. One of the things that he points out is that only about 10% of the population really wants freedom. The majority of the population, in his assessment, as a professional, I mean, this is what he does, study crowds and crowd behavior. The majority of the population wants to be told what to do. And one of the core tenets in authoritarianism that's been documented, you know, for decades now, Hannah Arendt and Gustave Le Bon, et cetera, is that if one is going to choose, if there is a desire to implement a totalitarian structure, the best leadership strategy is to be very domineering. People seem to want to have an authoritarian leader. That's why authoritarianism and totalitarianism always come together like this. One of the things that he and I are talking about a lot more recently is that totalitarianism, we often think, well, it's going to be like Stalin or it's going to be like Hitler, right? Each time it manifests in subtly different ways. And one of the ways that I think we're seeing this one develop is a way that was predicted a few years ago, inverse totalitarianism. We have effectively this fusion of corporate interests and the bureaucracy, the entrenched bureaucracy, which is what makes it inverted. It's not the elected political leaders or the appointed political leader, whatever the, you know, typically in a totalitarian structure, you have a small number of leaders at the summit that function as the political elite. But what we have, I think, growing here in the United States, and really, if you think about the World Economic Forum, it's kind of like that too, is you have these bureaucratic functionaries that represent a more subtle, quiet, established leadership that are acting in unilateral, authoritarian, totalitarian fashion, but they are much less visible except for folks like you and me that are living in the moment and obsessing over it.
Well, I am very cautious about imagining that I know more than I do about what is actually driving. I think we can feel the force that is arrayed against us. We can say something about how powerful it is, what kinds of tools it has at its disposal. We can say a little bit about the fact that it is at least not entirely a conspiracy. That there is at least a component of it that is evolved, that is emergent. But I do not know, to the extent that it behaves like an inverted totalitarian state, I don't know that it isn't a cryptic traditional one, right, where we can't see the connections. And I'm especially cautious about it because I think its relationship to nation states is increasingly, it's a constraint that it must deal with. The fact that we still believe that we function in nations is real and it has an impact. But for example, the apparent agreement amongst the Five Eyes countries to, well, my government can't invade my privacy, but there's no... Yeah, but the British government can apparently invade my privacy and the American government can ask them to do it, right? Obviously, that is a violation of the spirit of the Bill of Rights. But the fact that we know that it takes place and that we know that these alliances exist and that we're not allowed to check in on them and that, you know, I'll go back to the issue of in the U.S., it is literally true that the executive branch, because it decides someday that you've crossed a line that it has outlined without any ability to question it, can decide that you can no longer avail yourself of, for example, a court in which you might be able to say, I am not a terrorist and, you know, show me the evidence that I am. That court doesn't exist because you're not even allowed to know that it's been designated. So the point is that structure, to the extent that some structure can un-American me, it can take away my American rights, right, and then expose me to who knows what that is decided at a global level, right? And we should probably at least touch on the fact that, you know, either this treaty with the WHO, many of us regard as a serious threat to sovereignty, this treaty that is supposed to provide a mechanism for managing a global pandemic. And I think all of us would agree that, you know, if we had good governance globally, we would like somebody in a position to do rational things above the level of nations because these pathogens do jump borders. But I don't think anybody who's been paying attention wants any governmental structure that exists on Earth today empowered to do these kinds of things because they obviously can't be trusted. I guess I've tripped over that line again. But I don't know. I don't know what we're up against. And I'm afraid of assuming we know more than we do because it will cause us to make errors in fighting it.
Fair enough. I'm a little further along in the spectrum. I'm choosing those words carefully. some might say I'm quite farther along in the spectrum, whatever that spectrum is.
You're listening to Dr. Robert Malone speaking with Brett Weinstein on the Dark Horse podcast, recorded on May 22nd, 2022 in Bath, England. There is about 1 hour, 30 minutes remaining in the conversation. Now back to the show.
Right. So the pandemic treaty. First off, we need to acknowledge that there is no treaty between the United States government and the World Health Organization. There's an agreement. We've agreed to fund them. We've agreed to engage and participate with them. But we do not have a treaty that has been reviewed by the Senate and approved. Second point, I think what you're talking, because there is a treaty on the table.
Yeah.
In addition to that treaty, there is the modification of the International Health Regulations, which is basically a modification of the, we can call it operating principles of the World Health Organization. That was submitted, I think it was January 28th, by our Health and Human Services, which is the document that currently seems to have most folks wound up, and I think is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
So these are modifications to what are functionally operating procedures that they call the International Health Regulations that we're proposing that create a path that would allow the Director General, currently Mr. Tedros, to unilaterally implement, declare a public health emergency for any reason. And it's been pointed out, you know, one hot button is it could be for gun violence. A case could be made that we have an epidemic of gun violence in the United States, which is compromising public health. That case can well be made, has been made multiple times. We could say that we have an epidemic of depression or anxiety. Those are all true. Mm-hmm. We do have those things. Or it could be because of monkeypox, just pulling a pathogen out of the hat for some reason. In the determination under these regulations would be made unilaterally by the Director General based on non-transparent sources. So they could be from anywhere. It could be Bill Gates calls him up and says, hey, we need a public health emergency. And it would convey powers to make recommendations which nation states would have to respond to within 48 hours. And if they did not comport with those regulations, it would authorize WHO and through that the United Nations to implement sanctions such as, for instance, we've seen with Russia regarding the Ukrainian situation. So this pathway does not require Senate concurrence. It's not a treaty based. And it's ostensibly based in international law and sets a precedent of a unelected, he's elected sort of. He was elected without opposition by unanimity for his recent reelection, the director general.
Right.
To implement policies and practices that our government had no control over.
Right, but I would just point out, this is the same story that I already told about the Department of Homeland Security. The idea is there are supposed to be checks that prevent you from making a law that says, actually, at my sole discretion, I can declare you a so-and-so, and then having declared you a so-and-so.
Oh, you're precisely right.
Right. This is the same thing. And so I think the problem is it's very hard to, you know, it's very hard to imagine exactly how it would go down, that the WHO is going to be dictating that we must impose mandates, right? It's very abstract. But the point is, once you've built that mechanism,
it can be deployed at any point.
It
precisely illuminates and illustrates the point you made at the beginning, which is this edifice has been built around us. And at any point, the key can be turned, which makes it the sword of Damocles. It's always hanging over our head. And all they have to do is choose to cut the cord and it'll cut our neck off, metaphorically. And I think this is a key idea that you're drilling in on, because this drives behavioral changes that in use of language and communication without ever having to cross the line.
Right.
It is an incredibly effective tool to generate self-censorship in behavior, thought, and speech.
I think of it as the opposite of goose-stepping, right? And the idea is, look, if totalitarianism goose-stepped its way in, we'd all know exactly what it was, right? This is the opposite. It's like, it's subtle enough. You've got to have a certain, you know, ability to track an argument and follow through. It's boring. It's boring. It's so boring that you're not going to notice it. And if somebody says it's happening, you're going to want them to stop talking about it because it's too abstract.
Right? It's insidious.
It is.
And it is relentless.
Yeah, it is relentless.
It's the relentless aspect that sometimes I have to fight the darkness inside myself when I encounter it.
Yeah.
Relentless denial of the data, of the facts, of the truth. We're in a world, it seems hyperbole, we're in a post-truth world.
Mm-hmm. Well, the truth, I mean, there is literally a memo that says if you say true things that cause people to distrust their government, you're guilty of terrorism. That's where we are.
It is so deeply Orwellian.
I think I was thinking this morning, that it's actually a step beyond Orwell, right?
It's like they've taken this is an original thought to me. It's as if they've taken the writings of Orwell in Animal Farm in 1984 and Brave New World and all those classic texts that and I probably, because we're of a certain generation, we had to read when we were young humans.
Yeah.
In our formative years, in those key years right before puberty, most of us had to encounter this logic and these thoughts. And it's as if they've taken those classic works and used them as textbooks, as a starting point. It really reminds me of Machiavelli's The Prince.
Mm-hmm.
But The Prince was actually written as a lodestone, as a guide for the young noble in the Balkanized world of Italy with Renaissance and post-Renaissance period. And it's as if they have taken these warning texts and taken them as a starting point and weaponized them.
I agree. And now I'm going to pivot us a little bit because I think this mirrors something that's going on in a different realm, one that's more home territory for both you and me and probably more fun to talk about, which is, you know, the sort of molecular inner workings of viruses and the way they interface with the body. But the connection is this. I learned something from you at this conference. You caused the dime to drop on something that I hadn't put together, which is I had become aware, of course, of the modification of the RNA in the RNA-based vaccines, a substitution of a nucleotide. But when I became aware that it had happened, I assumed that that had been information that was available all along and that I had somehow overlooked it. That's not right, is it?
So you're speaking of the incorporation of pseudouridine.
Yep.
And just for the audience, so we're all kind of on the same page.
Yep.
This to kind of comprehend this without going too deep into the weeds. The process that this synthetic RNA is by which it's manufactured is that a plasmid DNA, a circular DNA, is manufactured in a bacteria where you can make large quantities of it. And it has encoded in it the sequences necessary to tell a particular enzyme, start here and go there and make an RNA based on this DNA template. Okay, and the enzyme that does that is T7 RNA polymerase. And when it does that, it has to grab the components, the nucleotides, as you mentioned, out of a solution. The enzyme, as it proceeds along the DNA track to make this like a string of pearls kind of product that is the RNA that comes off of that polymerase, the polymerase enzyme has to grab these molecules out of solution. And the molecular mix is relatively homogeneous, but somewhat random. The way it's done is in the tube, metaphorically, of course, this is happening in a larger volume now. In the tube, you add A, U, G, and C, these four fundamental components, as opposed to the digital world that we're familiar with, which only has two, a zero and a one. In nucleic acids, there's four components, A, U, G, C, or A, T, G, C, and DNA, just to get the fundamentals out. And in natural RNA, there is a uracil or uridine base that is one of these four. It's the U, A, U, G, C, that goes into the RNA, and it is polymerized in the cell in the same kind of process. And then in the cell, there's a specific enzyme that will act at specific points in the RNA, and we're still learning that. We're learning about what makes that enzyme decide to change that particular uridine to a pseudouridine. It's a chemical modification catalyzed by an enzyme, and it's very precisely controlled. And
very precisely controlled
in a functioning cell. And it's very precisely controlled because the implications of where it does that modification are huge in the biology of that subsequent RNA and what it does, how it gets spliced, which is to say kind of molecularly recombined, how long it lasts in the cell, and it also affects the RNAs apparently influence a lot of pathways involved in your immune response. And so all of these things are regulated, and the pseudouridine changes how the RNA folds is a whole bunch of intricate cool stuff if you're an RNA wonk. And the difference is that, number one, we really don't understand how all that works yet. So this is the part about coming to terms with our own ignorance.
Yeah, well, precautionary principle wise,
just so
it's a red flag.
And so what's done in the synthetic RNA that's produced in a factory that employs this patent of Carrico and Weissman, which is held by UPenn and licensed to BioNTech and to Moderna, is that they put all of the U's, or most of the U's, are pseudouridines. And they incorporate them randomly throughout the RNA at very high density.
Yep.
And so what this results in is an RNA that is not natural. It is something different. It's not what would be normally in the cell. And yet physicians were reassured by the pharmaceutical industry that the behavior of this artificial RNA in terms of how long it sticks in the cell and its underlying biology was the same as a natural RNA. And this was actively told when physicians asked, typically they would ask the pharmaceutical rep or whatever for information. Well, how long does this drug stick around? Which is a normal thing to ask. Okay, we call that pharmacokinetics is the fancy yep. word for it. How long does the drug last in your body before it gets decomposed? One of the fundamental characteristics that is always analyzed with any new pharmaceutical. Those studies actually weren't done.
Yep.
Nor were the, where does the drug go in your body? The fancy word for that is pharmacodistribution. And how long is it active? That's pharmacokinetics. None of that stuff was done. It was done to a limited extent, but not rigorously, and not looking at this full cascade that the RNA is actually not really the drug. It's sort of the drug. But the active principle is the thing that the RNA makes, the protein, which makes it complex, and it really doesn't fit regular vaccine regulatory paradigms.
Right.
So then fast forward, Katie Carrico knew because I'd spoken to her. She called me about a decade after I'd done the initial work and asked for my help. And I said, because she wanted to work on RNA and RNA delivery. And I said, the big problem with the system is that it is incredibly inflammatory. It essentially, giving it common language, it causes pus formation when you inject it into a variety of tissues. And pain and swelling and redness, classic signs of inflammation. And so I said, I told her people that she could talk to. And she and Drew Weissman, who's a Fauci postdoc at Penn, had the brainstorm that they would take this new biologic finding, pseudouridine, which was known at the time to have some effect on inflammation associated with RNA. And they said, we'll just put a whole lot of pseudouridine in the RNA. And lo and behold, it produced a product that would produce protein for longer and at higher levels when it was administered into an animal. And so this was the basis for that patent. Moderna actually didn't want to license it. Katie is a vice president at BioNTech, so it was always part of the BioNTech portfolio. And there's another third player in the RNA vaccine space called CureVac, which is also in Germany. And they've never used pseudouridine. And actually, the immune responses of their RNA formulations, which are basically the same, except they don't have the pseudouridine, in humans are very similar. But this was the position that was taken by these two scientists who had close ties to NIH. And that is why that pseudouridine is incorporated that way in all of the artificial RNAs that any of us that have taken the RNA vaccines have received. And then fast forward to the present, and we have these odd observations about immunosuppression. And then we had this paper come out in Cell in January from this team from Stanford that did the fine needle aspirations. So they actually pulled cells out of people's bodies. It wasn't in a test tube or in a petri dish. And they said, how long does this RNA stick around? And it turns out that it doesn't stick around for half an hour, or 2 hours, which is what the pharma had been telling the physicians. But in fact, it sticks around for at least 60 days. They didn't test beyond that.
Right.
And furthermore, it produces more protein in your blood, more spike protein of the, remember, this is one of the things I got fact-checked on after our infamous interview,
yep.
that spike is absolutely not a toxin. The spike that's in the vaccine is not a toxin.
That's what they claimed.
The spike has two main components, S2 that kind of stays in the cell and gets cut from the other part that's extracellular called S1 that circulates and binds to ACE2 and does all this wonderful stuff. In the vaccine and in the virus, the S1 is identical. In the vaccine and the virus, the S2 is almost identical, except for it has two little point mutations, two prolines, which are there that makes the product, when it's expressed, more immunogenic from an antibody standpoint.
And I think you taught me this. They locked it open. They basically took the scissors and they put a weld so that the scissors are locked open.
Well, we look at it.
And the reason that they did that was because the outside of the protein naturally accumulates sugars, which is probably an evolved defense of the virus so that it doesn't get spotted. And so by locking it open, they expose a part of the protein that the immune system can then see and register. So at the level of, can you make a vaccine that stimulates the immune system? This makes sense. But they took a toxic protein and they locked it open and left it otherwise
similar.
So that,
similar. When I said that to you, I got that partially wrong.
Okay.
And I got pushback from molecular virologists on that, and I had to dive deeper into it and correct that. So thanks for bringing that up.
Great.
I got it wrong. It was my best understanding at the time that those two proline mutations do alter the immunogenicity, but they don't really lock the receptor binding domain pockets open, like I was saying. And now I know that those receptor binding domains, this protein that we talk about spike so casually is a fascinating molecule, as all of these viral receptors that have dual functions. They bind and then they also trigger the fusion event that allows the nucleic acid to get into the cell. In the case of the spike protein, I like to use the metaphor, it's like a treble fish hook. Right? Mm-hmm. Understand what a treble hook looks like.
Sure.
And if you think about the barbs on the treble hook, those are akin to the receptor binding domain. And if you think about the part where you tie the knot onto the fishing line, that's really S2. That little loop down there is kind of like S2. So if you've got that metaphor in your mind, then you can imagine each of those barbs are completely flexible. They can rotate. Okay. And that's what the receptor binding domain does. And those two-point mutations alter the conformation of that three component trimer that is spike, and alter the conformational change capability to undergo the conformational change associated with the fusion versus pre-fusion conformation. Remember I said they has this dual function? But so that part is true. It does make it more immunogenic. It does alter it locks it into the pre-fusion conformation. So it can't undergo that change, but I was wrong. It does not affect the receptor binding domains, which are floating out there kind of free. And it makes sense I know you love biology and evolution and biochemistry. And so you can imagine these things have, huge conformational freedom to find their cognate receptor. So that's, thank you for mentioning that, but this is really in the weeds most.
Let's go back to the pseudouridine in the mRNA, because I really wanted to get at something actually kind of simple. I appreciate your explanation of how it gets there, but I feel I was lied to in the same way that you're describing that doctors who were interested in the contents of the vaccine and their durability in the cell were lied to, because I was repeating, it's an mRNA. It's been encased in these lipid nanoparticles. The lipid nanoparticles have an affinity for cells because the cells have a lipid on their surface. That gives me some sort of a ballpark as a biologist to say, well, how novel is this, right? The lipid nanoparticles, highly novel. I can see that. The mRNA, it's highly novel in the sequence, but it's not highly novel to have an mRNA floating
structure
in the cytoplasm. Yeah. And so I have some sort of intuitive sense about what that would mean about how durable the thing would be. Because for one thing, the body doesn't like free mRNAs.
It doesn't like foreign nucleic acids.
Right.
It absolutely hates foreign nucleic acids. It's got all kinds of barriers for good reason.
Right. So you would imagine. And in fact, the story when the vaccines first came out was that one of the challenges was getting enough of the stuff intact into the cells to get it to work. Right. So, okay, this sets up in the mind a sense where the novel aspects that are introduced into the body are not long lived. So, yes, there's a lot of danger in this vaccine, but at least if you survive the period where it interacts with your cells,
which ostensibly is just a few hours.
Right. So at the point that I found out, oh, wait a minute. This isn't mRNA in the standard sense. My standard model for mRNA doesn't work. It doesn't tell me how long. It's as if you dropped a fiberglass log in the forest. And it's like, well, logs in the forest, they get eaten by termites and fungi and things
like that. Interesting metaphor.
I know how long that takes, roughly. Uh-huh. Depends on the forest. But whatever, I've got some model. Well, that fiberglass log might last an awfully long time in that forest because it's not really a log at all. And so anyway,
Well, let's run with your metaphor for just a minute.
All right.
Okay. I love the metaphor. Okay. So, because it has a length, two-dimensional aspect. So that's good. And it's very long lived and it's composed of fibers. I mean, we don't have to go too down in the metaphor.
Yeah.
So the log in the forest as the metaphor for the RNA. One of the things that has Ryan Cole and I really worried, and we've discussed how to do the experiment, but we're all too busy and it takes money. Okay. Now imagine that log in the forest. Okay. Now we're going to place that log into the cell, metaphorically speaking. Okay. And that log has a function. It processes something that causes something to be made that happens to be toxic. Okay. And yet the cell now, or the forest in the metaphor, can never degrade it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that foreign thing that it makes can cause that cell to get attacked.
Will cause it to get attacked.
If you're successful in generating an immune response and a T cell response in particular, the cells that have that RNA, they're making that spike protein, will get attacked.
So hold on. I want to pause you because I advanced a hypothesis on Dark Horse, which has now just come right back up. So I want to catch people up and then I want you to pick up your explanation. So what I argued, and I believe I came up with this independently, but I believe Peter McCullough has mentioned something similar, as has Jonathan Cooey. The idea is, the body has a way to recognize cells that have been virally infected.
Yes.
Cells that have been virally infected have a quirk, which is their surface has a mixture of self proteins, which the body recognizes, and non-self proteins, which it recognizes by virtue of the fact that it doesn't know what they are. When a cell has those two things on its surface, the only thing it can be from a biological perspective is a virally infected cell. And a virally infected
cell... Or cancer cell.
I guess it could be, well, yeah, because the non-self is self, but it's sufficiently
changed. It's a mutated self.
Right, okay, so okay. Fair enough. The point is, in either of those cases, there is one and only one right thing to do, and that is to destroy the cell, right? And the problem
is...
It's a simple switch. If that cell is in your heart, well, now you've got two problems, because you've got your immune system attacking the cells in the heart, and your heart doesn't repair, it scars.
Bingo.
Right? And so the point is, you could get a lot of scar tissue in your heart. You might get away with it. It might diminish the longevity of your heart. It might reduce its capacity to pump blood, or you might have just a little damage and you would be sub-threshold.
But all true.
Anyway, so the point is...
Yeah, we could go down that rabbit hole if you want.
We, with this, with the mRNA-based vaccines at least, we set people who receive those injections up for their immune system to attack their own cells on the basis that they had been virally infected. And then this issue of the change, the altered mRNA, makes it vastly worse, because the point is, it's not that the cell stops producing the foreign protein and maybe the immune system hasn't gotten around to killing it and that cell can go back to being a normal cell. The point is, now that mRNA might be very long-lived, and that cell is going to continue to produce foreign protein until some T cell, cytotoxic T cell, comes and kills it out, or a natural killer cell.
Or antibody-dependent cytotoxicity, cellular cytotoxicity. So all true.
Yeah.
Concur.
Okay.
And more so.
So what that says is, like, what you want, at the point that they say, all right, we've got a pandemic, we've got some vaccines, don't worry, they're good vaccines, we've tested them, and you're trying to check whether or not what they're saying makes sense. The question is, how novel is that thing you want to inject into me, right? Lipid nanoparticles, red flag, okay?
Should have been well characterized pharmaceutically.
Right, but there ain't no natural version of that, right? That is
correct.
A non-targeted
correct.
Mechanism for invading cells. It's if, you know, it's dependent.
In normal vaccinology, the characterization of the pharmacologic toxicology associated with that component, if, for instance, if we were to define it as an adjuvant.
Yeah, right.
Would typically require years.
Mm-hmm. All right. So that was one red flag. That one set me off, right? I could see that that was a hazard. Didn't mean it wasn't brilliant. I mean, I think it may in fact
doesn't
be.
Doesn't matter. Well, it is what it is.
It is what it is. But it's at least from the point of view of the more novel your remedy is, the more likely it has consequences you don't know about that you're not going to like. Right now, so add on top of that. So I missed that the payload also had a similar level of novelty here.
Yes.
Which was that the mRNA wasn't really mRNA. It was very special mRNA that might.
I suggest it should not be called mRNA. It is a long-lived polynucleotide, single-stranded polynucleotide, which can be translated, but it is really not mRNA. I think it deserves its own language.
Yeah, it at least deserves another letter, right? It deserves another letter, something that will call your attention to the fact that there's a novelty.
mRNA, synthetic mRNA, or something.
Right, something like that. And anyway, so at the point that you mentioned at the conference what this was, and the dime dropped that it wasn't that I had missed this at the beginning, is that they forgot to mention it, right? And it's like a huge thing to forget to mention. I felt again burned by this whole story, because with that piece of information, I could have been that much clearer about the novelty and the danger, and you know, we could have had a better discussion. But
so let me. There's two corollaries.
Yep.
This is 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. My show runs every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. You're listening to a conversation with Dr. Robert Malone and Brett Weinstein on Brett's The Dark Horse podcast. There's about 60 minutes remaining in this conversation. Now back to the show.
With this long-lived RNA or synthetic polynucleotide, single-stranded polynucleotide, the pharmacokinetics, the degradation of it, the clearance of it in your body is super important if one is interpreting the range of adverse events that are temporally, in other words, with time, associated with the administration of the drug. Okay, so we have been told, and it has been the dogma, that, for instance, as you analyze bears or fill in the blank database, that we should really not focus on any adverse events, particularly things that look like acute adverse events as opposed to the delayed autoimmune things, but acute adverse events like myocardial damage that occur after about 2 weeks. Those are considered probably just background noise from whatever the physiology of the person was, because it was assumed that the RNA only lasted a very brief period of time. Now we functionally have to go back, if we were being honest, if we were acting with integrity, scientific integrity, we would go back and say, oh, darn, we missed that. We need to go back and analyze the full profile of data and adverse events and recalculate the adverse event rate, because we now know that this thing sticks around in your body for at least 2 months.
So
okay, there's that.
This is part of the gaslighting, right? So, the people who are still honest enough to try to interpret this and have the technical chops to understand what they're looking at, this was some kind of red herring. Because if you were trying to build a model, you've got all of these people who believe that they have had injury from the vaccine. What is the injury? How plausible is it that it came from the vaccine? Well, if you don't know that the mRNA isn't mRNA and that it might be sticking around a very long time, right? Then the point is the likelihood that those delayed reactions are the result of the vaccine skyrockets.
Right.
So if you didn't know that, then the point is you think,
It means that all of our prior interpretation about correlation between adverse events and the inoculation, I'm going to call it, I'm really trying to move away from calling these vaccines.
Yep.
They really no longer meet the criteria of vaccines. They're more like some sort of immunotherapeutic inoculation. Language matters.
It does.
Okay. And the term vaccine is clearly overly broad. So we must, if we are acting with integrity, we must go back and reevaluate our prior assumptions and reevaluate the safety database in light of this Cell paper, which, by the way, they totally buried the lead. If you look at the title of that Cell paper, you would never guess that it had this crucial data about the pharmacokinetics of the RNA or the relative levels of expression of the spike protein compared to in the naturally infected in your circulating blood. You wouldn't know it if you read the title. Surprise.
Right. In fact, I didn't know this until I heard you mention it out loud and put the stuff together, and it was
so now there's
clear.
Another, I said there's two branches to this.
Yeah.
You've kind of mined the implications in cellular immunology, which we all knew historically. The other one is that's most worrisome, and this has to do with pattern recognition, putting together pieces of information that are fragmented in the landscape. There's this observation that has been made that there are migratory white blood cells in your body that will call for simplicity, we'll call them macrophage, that move around in your body and control, you know, there's dendritic cells, a whole bunch of different flavors of these things, as you know, but we'll just call them macrophages, and or monocytes. And there is a subpopulation of these that you can pull out of people's bodies and you can analyze them in flow cytometry, cool tech, that continue to carry spike protein.